the promise of land in the Near East for the people of God was not then therefore simply a promise of real estate. It was a promise of God's continued favor, and that they would have this land, which would be the kingdom of God on earth, because it's where Yahweh, God, ruled, and not any pagan deities. So that was important. And after Moses' death, it was Joshua who led the people on the conquest of this land, the resettling of it in what we now call Palestine. Joshua, by the way, is the Hebrew pronunciation for the same name as Jesus. His name in Hebrew would have been Joshua. What we had then after Israel migrated into Palestine was what's called a tribal amphictyony. There's one for the next time you play Scrabble. An amphictyony is a common defense pact, a defense pact formed around a common religious shrine. And we have several holy places in Israel, Bethel, for example, and of course Jerusalem, that were holy places. And we have this tribal mutual defense pact around them. But there's no central organized government. And so the people come to the prophet Nathan and they say, we would like to have a king. We'd like to form a centralized government. And of course, Nathan is appalled. He says, but God is your king. See, he's thinking of the suzerainty treaty and what that means. It means that God is the suzerain of Israel. When he presents the people's demand to God in prayer, God says, well, I'm going to let them have a king. It surprises Nathan very much. But he says, you've got to warn them that there are a lot of freight comes along with having a king. You're going to have a royal court. And you're going to have people that are royalty and better than others and all kinds of things. Kings can oppress you with taxes. People say, we hear all that, but we still want a king. So they wanted and got centralized government. And then we have the story of the first king of Israel, who was Saul, and who tried to defeat the surrounding tribes and didn't complete it. But Saul was also disobedient to God. And so God punished him by having him lose a battle. And when it was clear to him that he was going to be captured, he committed suicide. And his successor was the great King David. And of course, we all, I guess from Sunday school, we all know the story of David being selected to be king and how that when Saul and his armies were lined up against the Philistine armies, their great champion, Goliath the giant, came out and challenged anyone to a fight. And little David, who was only a boy, went out with his slingshot and nailed the giant between the eyes, and he went down, and that was the end of him. And David became famous even as a youngster. So David succeeds as king, and God gives his armies success, and he unifies the kingdom and brings it under rule, central rule. And if we're putting this in time again, David is around 950 before Christ. But maybe 1,000, maybe as long ago as 1,000, but between 1,000 and 950. And then we have the account of the kingdom and strife within it and so on. The kingdom divides after David. the North has its king and the South has its king, and there's the constant battle with the inroads that pagan religion keeps making into Israel. The whole system of law that had been set down in the law of Moses about how to dress and how to eat and what holy days to observe and you're not to trim your beard and don't eat this and so on. All of that was for one reason, and the reason is given so that you will come out and be separate from among all the other nations, and you will preserve the worship of the one true God and not be deceived into going after strange and false gods. Nevertheless, that was a constant battle, and it was the prophets who called people back to covenant faithfulness when they would stray. Samuel and Saul, for example. And Nathan, the prophet, with King David. It's very remarkable that the story of David's sin with when he saw Bathsheba and he wanted her to be his wife. And David's sin wasn't adultery, it was murder. He married Bathsheba after he arranged for her husband to be killed. And the prophet Nathan appears to him, to David in the throne room, and he says, "I have a story to tell you. There was a man who was very wealthy, had plenty of sheep and so on, and goats and camels, and he had guests coming, and he wanted to prepare a special meal for them. Now, not far away, there was a very poor man who only had one sheep, and that's what kept him warm at night and gave him milk and so on. And so this rich man stole the sheep from the poor man, killed it, and served it to his guests." And David says, "Tell me the name of this man, and I'll have him executed. That's terrible." And Nathan says, "You're the man." Of course, this is an analogy. This is a story. You who could have anything you want, you who are wealthy, you go take the wife away from a man who's relatively poor, and you killed him to do it. Now, the amazing thing about this story is that it got into the record at all. The king has control over the royal chronicles, over the records of what's done in the kingdom. How did that story get in there when it paints David in such a terrible light when he's the one in charge of the records? And the answer is that the king didn't have absolute authority. That the prophet, as the spokesman from God, could say this and have it go into the record, and the king could do nothing about it. We have no reason to think he tried, but even had he tried, it would not have succeeded. The prophet had an independent kind of authority, and David respected that. David's reply to the prophet is, "I repent, I've done wrong," and then we get the penitential psalms that he wrote and so on. And he acknowledged his sin, confessed it, and was forgiven. So, but it's a remarkable story, and it shows the division of authority, that the religious authority trumps the civil authority in ancient Israel. And of course, David is not the one then to build the temple and to God. That falls to his son, Solomon. So it's, and Solomon and the temple is maybe 900 to 970. This is maybe 1,000 to 950. And it's Solomon could be 970, say. I'm not saying this is when this is their lifespan. I'm saying you place them within these parameters as they are best guesses. And we have successive stories then of people being faithful and people not being faithful, of kings that walked with God, that promoted the religion of God, that saw to the reading of the covenant, and those that didn't. We get some particularly nasty characters that arise here too. The nation, the northern part of the nation, is infected by the worship of Baal. It's a storm god, Palestinian storm god. And you have that famous story then of Elijah challenging the priests of Baal to a contest on the mountain, and their defeat there, who is the true God. And you have then other incursions of pagan religion, and chief among those is the religion brought into Israel by Jezebel, the wife of King Ahab. Ahab is described as a wicked king, although we know from history that he was an efficient administrator and good at his job, but he's being written up by the scribes who are keeping these records and who are writing everything from the point of view of God's covenant. And from that point of view, he's not a good king. He's an evil one. And he brings in a pagan wife who brings pagan worship, creates what they call groves and high places. They used to put their idols there and burn incense to them and so on. And Jezebel threatens to have God's prophet Elijah killed, and he has to run away and hide. But then there's a reform movement that arises under Jehu, and he discovers this ancient document, and part of it is read, and it's repeated. It's part of the covenant. It's part of Deuteronomy. And he restores the worship of God and has Jezebel executed. This goes back and forth like this till finally the northern kingdom, because keeps turning to paganism, is punished by God and goes into captivity to Assyria. That's roughly 740 BC. So the northern kingdom has fallen. But the southern kingdom called, and they were then called, the northern kingdom was called Israel, and the southern kingdom was called Judah. And that's where Jerusalem was. So the northern kingdom has fallen, but Judah has not. And the temple still exists there, Solomon's temple in Jerusalem. And Jews from all over still try to make a pilgrimage there. And it is still the center of worship for Israel. The temple was a remarkable building. It was known all over the ancient world as one of the great feats of architecture and one of the most elaborately decorated. It was decorated with gold and silver and with precious stones and jewels of all kinds. And as you know, I probably already know this, it had an outer court and then it had an inner court. This courtyard out here is for the people, but then the priests could go in here. And there was a table for this, what they called the showbread and the laver, which was a wash basin. And then inside the innermost part was the Ark of the Covenant of God with the tablets of stone on which Moses had rewritten the commandments. And only the high priest went in here, and only once a year. And the day that the high priest would go in there was called Yom Kippur. We say Yom Kippur. It's the day of covering. And he goes in with a small basin with sheep's blood in it or something. And he sprinkles it on the top of this Ark of the Covenant, because that top is where God sits. It's called the mercy seat of God. And if you think it's grisly that he's sprinkling animal blood there, it's not. It's to symbolize the fact that the people deserve to die for their sins. If they have violated the covenant with God, what they really deserve is death. But God accepts the death of this animal in their place. It's a substitution. It's a demonstration of God's mercy. And that's why it's called the mercy seat of God himself in the temple. And then, meanwhile, outside in the courtyard, the people's worship includes taking a piece of paper in which they've written their sins, tie it around the neck of a goat, and let the goat go into the wilderness to die. Again, a goat dies in place of me. I deserve to die for the sins that I've done, but God allows me to put this off on this goat. The goat's called a scapegoat. It escapes into the wilderness. We still use that expression for somebody taking the blame for someone else. That was the symbolism, the very rich symbolism that was involved here in this worship. But then when Israel falls, the records then are kept in Judah, in the south, and in Jerusalem, in the capital. And Jerusalem itself lasts another couple of hundred years, 140 years, before it is also conquered, this by the Babylonians. And again, the people who keep the records are writing from the point of view of covenant. They're saying it's covenant unfaithfulness here. It's judgment of God that the Babylonians have now conquered the southern kingdom. They've conquered the capital of Jerusalem, and not only that, worst thing of all, the most awful catastrophe any Jew could think of, they destroyed the temple. The Babylonians destroyed it in 586. And from this point on, Israel was never an independent nation again. The Babylonians were toppled. There's a succession of conquests. The Babylonians are toppled by the Medes and the Persians, and then they're toppled, and it keeps going until they come to the Romans, take over everything. And if one after another of these captivities ensues. But what's important is that after this Babylonian captivity, when it's over, the Jews are allowed to return to Jerusalem and rebuild the temple. It takes place under the direction of two people, Ezra and Nehemiah. And they direct the rebuilding, and it's of course it's not Solomon's, but it's still a magnificent building, and it's still magnificently decorated, and it was once again known all over the ancient world as a marvel of architecture. Now, I'm going to come later to the developments under these successive captivities and the development of Jewish thought and doctrine. And the writings, and we'll have more of that, and we'll begin that with the next talk. We'll see you then.